All right, well, let me take you on a magical tour to my adolescence or something when so I have a very simple picture of reality. Yes, physicists talk about all of these complicated things that I don't really understand, but at the bottom, I know what they're talking about. Okay, just the state of the world can be represented by some finite string of bits. Okay, and those bits are going to evolve in time by some kind of local rules, and they'll kind of produce the appearance of continuity on a large scale, the same way that happens on a computer screen or, in a Nintendo game or whatever. The specific form of the rules is not of that great consequence, because anything you can do in one, programming language or with one rules, right, you can do with any other set of rules, right? All right. So maybe this is not such a tough sell to this audience, but I think the reason to be interested in quantum computing. I've never, stayed up at night, hungering for the factors of a 600-digit integer. Even one that protected someone else's email. I don't know. Quantum computing challenges this picture, and I think this is at the same time it's the reason why some computer scientists and physicists have been extremely skeptical of it and have said it can't possibly be the right description of reality. And at the same time, this is the reason to be interested in it, to find out if this is the right picture of reality. We're putting quantum mechanics to a type of test that it's really never been put to before, because we're not talking about just a entanglement or about uncertainty or so on. We're talking about some exponential number of parallel, whatever you want to call them. I'm not a philosopher, but exponential somethings that are going to somehow contribute to some outcome. And the question is that really the right description? So there are some computer scientists who don't think it is. One of them is Oded Goldreich. A year and a half ago, he posted an essay to his webpage where he argues that quantum computing is basically an extravagant model, or at least that the burden is on the quantum computing proponents to prove otherwise. So in other words, he might change his opinion if someone, I were to actually factor a 600-digit integer, right? Whereas for some of the other skeptics, it's not clear that they would change their opinion even then. So he says, well, as far as he's concerned, the quantum computing model consists of exponentially long vectors, simple or uniform operations on such vectors. The key point is that each operation can be affected at unit cost. He's concerned with that postulate. He says, my own intuition is that the cost of such an operation should be linearly related to the amount of non-degeneracy of these vectors. Needless to say, I'm not suggesting a concrete definition of non-degeneracy. I'm merely conjecturing that such exists and that it captures the inherent cost of the computation. Thing is, if you look back to the history of computational complexity, this does not seem like such an unreasonable view, because there's been one claim after another, of people saying that they could, make hypercomputers or, some kind of computer that would do the first step in 1 second, and the next step in half a second, and then the next one in a quarter of a second, and so on, so that it does an infinite number of steps in 2 seconds. They'd say, well. This computer can represent an exponential amount of information, just like in the decimal expansion of the voltage of this across this gap or something. But then, all right, well, this is not a continuous parameter over which we have complete control, right? This is you know, ultimately, in fact, quantum effects come into a play, and then it's a discrete number of electrons that we're talking about, right? I mean, even just setting aside the issue of noise. So our experience has just invariably been that when you analyze these kind of claims to do an exponential amount of stuff in a polynomial amount of time, you discover that, you know, someone is sweeping something under the rug, right? And so, you know, the way some computer scientists reacted is, well, why should quantum computing be any different? So I'm going to give a two-pronged response, although, and I gave this talk to complexity theorists, so Sanjeev Arora suggested it should be a three-pronged response, thereby forming a psi-shaped pitchfork. But I don't have a third prong yet. You can help me. But all right. So my first prong is, you know, again, this might not come as such a surprise to you, but there is something to say here, and it's not easy to explain current experiments, you know, let alone sort of hypothetical future ones, if you don't accept that quantum states are in some sense exponentially long vectors. You know, the sense I mean is that to describe a state of n particles, you really do need an exponential number of parameters. And this is related to a paper I had a couple years ago, which maybe some of you have seen. I'll just talk about it briefly, which was called Multilinear Formulas and Skepticism of Quantum Computing. Okay, and my second prong is, but it's not that bad. In particular, it's not that much worse than something else, which is that, well, if you were to just take a classical coin and just flip it, you know, 1,000 times, you'll also get exponentially small numbers. You know, well, if you flip it n times, you'll get exponentially small numbers, 2^-1,000 is a constant. But So you'll get, and in fact, you'll get an exponential number of exponentially small numbers. But, you know, no one on this basis kind of rejects classical probability theory as being extravagant, or says that, well, it could only be an approximation to some deeper sort of probability theory. So I'm going to sort of put quantum states and probability distributions kind of head to head in death match, as it were. And see how they compare in complexity theoretic settings. So, all right. So let me just say a little about prong one. So I guess the first question is just, well, how good is the evidence for quantum mechanics? We've got interference. But if you don't have interference, electrons don't have quantized its energy levels. All the matter in the universe disintegrates. And in addition, there's the double slit experiment. You've got entanglement. You've got Schrodinger cats, and you probably know about these experiments where you can do the double slit experiment, but with buckyballs, and you can, get a superposition of electrons flowing clockwise around the wire and flowing counterclockwise in the superconductivity experiments, and there are other cases where it seems like you can have enough particles in coherent superposition that if you could build a general purpose quantum computer with that same number of particles, then you're already, you know, in quote unquote the quantum computing regime, right? So the way I frame the issue is exactly what property separates the Schur states that we know we can create from the Schur states that suffice for factoring. I want some dividing line. I want such a Schur separator. Okay, and that's been my challenge to skeptics. None have risen to the challenge. When I talk to Oded Goldreich about it, for example, he says, "Well, it's my responsibility to figure out what the separator is, right? You know, it's enough for him to just know that it exists. So for a priori reasons, right? So that didn't quite satisfy me. And so what I did was I found myself thinking like a skeptic, saying, well, if I didn't believe quantum mechanics, what such dividing line would I come up with, right? I mean, you know, it's actually kind of an interesting puzzle once you start thinking about it, because it's not so easy to come up with one. So let me give you some examples that might illustrate the difficulty. So the first thing that you hear a lot of computer scientists say, as I mentioned, was that, well, there are these exponentially small amplitudes, and in reality, exponentially small anything is unreasonable. It will always be swamped by noise. But I mean, look, all right, take n photons and polarize them each at 45 degrees, okay? You've got 2 to the n amplitudes, which are each 2 to the minus n over 2, but you don't even have any entanglement, right? You're just, so presumably, you know, not even the most hardcore skeptic is going to dispute that you can do that, and that the resulting state will, you know, should be described in that way. And as I mentioned, it's not going to be entanglement across hundreds of particles either, because we can prepare such entanglement. And it's not going to be a combination of the two, because we could just take the cat's fate and look at it in a different basis. So the question is, you know, I mean one way to put it, as I thought about this, is that well. Once you accept these kind of two basic axioms of quantum mechanics, that, well, if you have two states, you can prepare them in two separate labs and thereby get the tensor product of those two states. And if you have two states, you can have a linear combination of it. Well, I mean, consistency almost forces you to just fill up the whole Hilbert space, right? And it doesn't seem like there's any kind of defensible place you can draw a line and say, all right, here, you know, here's the reasonable states, and you know, here, but you know, above, beyond this, you know, Darby dragons and Darby factoring and so on, right? So how do you do that? So my thought was, well, maybe it would be more natural to a logician or something than a physicist, but you could take just take the closure of those two operations, linear combination and tensor product, under a polynomial number of applications. Okay, so we get a class of states that I call tree states, which is the class of all n qubit quantum states, which are expressible by a tree of linear combinations and tensor products of size bounded by a polynomial in n. So this is an example of such a tree representing a state, and if you think about it, you find that a very, very large number of the natural quantum states that people think about actually are tree states. Okay, that's what kind of justifies this or makes it interesting. First of all, Schrödinger cat states, of course, have linear tree size. You know, any unentangled state has small tree size. But you know, like a superposition over all strings of even parity, or even over all integers written in binary, which are divisible by 3, right? That seems kind of complicated, but that actually has a polynomial size tree representation. One-dimensional cluster states, so like a one-dimensional lattice of spins with pairwise nearest neighbor interactions. Again, that seems a bit complicated, but I can prove that such a state has a tree size of O of n to the 4. If there are n spins, so then the question presents itself of kind of, are there natural quantum states or states that we can already prepare or will soon be able to prepare or something that do not have such a polynomial size tree representation? Okay, that if you try to write them down on paper using just plus signs and cats and parentheses and no summation signs, then you know it'll take you a lot of paper. Okay, are there such states that we've seen in the lab? That's the question. So And my main result was to use actually very, very recent technology from theoretical computer science. In particular, a recent result of due to Ron Ruz, which gave the first super polynomial lower bounds on what are called multilinear formula complexity, or like the number of additions and multilinear multiplications that you need to represent certain polynomials. And this had been a long-standing open problem. And about a month before I needed such lower bounds, Ron Ruz was able to prove them fortuitously. So I applied this to some of the quantum states that people are interested in for quantum computing. And so one example of what I was able to show is that if you pick a generator matrix uniformly at random for a linear error correcting code, and then you take a uniform superposition over all code words of that code, then with very high probability over the generator matrix, that state will have super polynomial tree size. Okay, in particular, it will have tree size at least, well, actually n to the epsilon log n, where epsilon is about 10 to the minus 6, but it's a constant. Okay. So, and, you know, of course, I believe that the truth is exponential, okay? I think that the actual tree size is going to be exponential in n, but unfortunately, Ruz's technique is only currently able to prove lower bounds of the form n to the log n. So I have other results. For example, I can show that even if you just wanted to approximate that state well in trace distance, that also requires super polynomial tree size. And then, you know, of course, well, since I'm looking for a Schur-Schur separator, the obvious question you might ask is, well, what about the states in Schur's algorithm? Do they have super polynomial tree size? And unfortunately, I was only able to show that assuming a number theoretic conjecture, which might have, you know, some relation to Artin's conjecture and the GRH and so on, although hopefully, you know, maybe it's easier than that. But I ask number theorists like Carl Pomerantz about it, and then they don't know how to solve it. Basically, what I need to show is that the set of if you take like a superposition, or let's say if you take a set of multiples of a fixed integer and write them out in binary, then that set of binary strings will constitute a good erasure code, right? And so, yeah, it involves looking at the powers of 2, kind of modulo some large prime number, which, if you know about number theory, you know that that's something that people really don't understand well. So, look, it's true, okay? The states in Schur's algorithm, do require these, you know, exponential size trees. It's a very hard thing to prove that. I'm starting to think like a physicist, but the other question, of course, is whether if you have a quantum computer, which is always in a tree state, or like at every time step, has a polynomial-sized tree representation, then can you simulate such a computer in classical polynomial time? And of course, that would make the tree states a lot more attractive as a separator. And so I wasn't able to show that. All I could show is that if you have such a quantum computer, you could simulate it in the third level of the polynomial time hierarchy, which we don't know how to do for unrestricted quantum computers. And I really don't understand why. I mean, like, I talked to condensed matter physicists who are interested in calculating ground states, and for some reason that didn't interest them. That you can do it in sigma 3 intersect pi 3, but they wanted something in B. But what can you do? All right. So let me move on to the second prong, which maybe fewer of you have seen, I guess. So This is that it's not that bad. So, so recall, I mean, we want to ask, okay, well, we'll suppose quantum states are these, do live in an exponentially large Hilbert space. I mean, well, how powerful is that? I mean, what does that let us do? I mean, is it if someone gives you a quantum state, you know, is that like being given some exponentially long classical string that, that might give you some sort of enormous power, right? And because we know something about quantum information theory, we might say, well, of course not. Of course it's different from that. But in the settings of complexity theory, it's not so obvious that basically for the more general reason that we hardly know how to prove anything, right? If some wizard were to give you some quantum state, maybe that would give you enormous computational power that you wouldn't have otherwise. Okay, so that's the question, and it's actually raised in Mike and Ike in the Nielsen Chang textbook. They ask a very good question. I thought they say we know that many systems in nature prefer to sit in highly entangled states of many systems. Might it be possible to exploit this preference to obtain extra computational power? And to a complexity theorist like me, I mean them's fighting words, okay, or at least complexity class defined in words, okay. So all right. So let's define a class that corresponds to this question. We'll call it BQP/QPoly. All right, BQP, of course, is the class of problems that you can solve in polynomial time with a quantum computer. The slash QPoly means that, so slash poly would mean that we're given a polynomial-sized classical advice string, which depends only on the input length n, right, and not on the input itself. So slash QPoly will mean we're given a polynomial-sized quantum advice state, which again, so we can imagine that maybe these quantum advice states were created in the Big Bang, and they've been sitting around ever since. But so they would take us exponential time, or maybe even more, if we tried to prepare them. So they could be very powerful. But the problem, of course, is that the Big Bang didn't anticipate what particular instances of satisfiability we want to decide. It just knows that we want to decide satisfiability. Okay. So we get these states. And are there any such states? It's polynomial size, well, in the length of the input, actually. Therefore, also, yeah. Yes. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Okay, I'm sorry. Yes, you're right. Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah, otherwise you would get BQP/QLog. Yeah. Uh-huh. Good, thanks. So all right, so then the obvious challenge is, how powerful is this quantum advice? And one way to put the question is it more powerful than classical advice? So in other words, to put this in capital letters, is BQP/QPoly equal to BQP/Poly, right? And the answer, this shouldn't surprise you very much, is, We can't answer any of these things, okay? But in this case, it's even worse because here we can't even get an Oracle separation between these two, okay? And this is not for lack of trying, at least on my part, one thing I can tell you about is I'm Greg Cooperberg, and I have been thinking about this lately. And what we can get is we can get a quantum Oracle separation. So we can say that if the BQP/Poly machine and the BQP/QPoly machine can both access some unitary matrix, which is an Oracle to them, then the BQP/QPoly machine is more powerful, right? But we don't know how to do that for a classical Oracle. And actually, we also have so like an Oracle separation would be evidence that it would be hard to show that these classes are equal, right? But what we can do is we can get evidence that it's hard to get an Oracle separation. So we can get some meta evidence. So all right. So So, you know, as usual, we don't know the answer, but we know something. All right, but why do I find this such a central question? Well, because, you know, if you imagine, let's say, you know, BQP slash X, or even P slash X, if we imagined a polynomial time machine, which is given an exponential amount of classical advice, then it's easy to see that that machine could solve any problem whatsoever, okay? And I really do mean any problem, okay? Well, why? Because you would just, the exponential advice would just have a big lookup table that would store the answers to every possible question of length n, and then whatever input you got, you just look up the answer, okay? Yeah, you assume it has random access, of course. All right, you can tell this is a computer scientist. All right, so, So if we think of quantum advice as similar to sort of, you know, this exponentially long vector to which you would have that sort of random access, you know, being able to get any entry you want, you know, it seems like, well, based on that intuition, such a thing could be extremely powerful. I mean, and so the question is, well, how powerful is it? Could it let us do things that, you know, we really don't know how to do or believe that we can't do with regular garden variety quantum computers, like, for example, solve NP complete problems in polynomial time, okay? And yeah, I guess anyone who knows me knows what my reaction to that is going to be, okay. I mean, you want to solve factoring, fine. You want to solve graph isomorphism, you know, that's even fine. But NP complete problems, all right. There, you know, we've got to figure out what's behind this, okay? So what am I going to show you? So first we're going to need yet another complexity class, okay? This one is called post BQP. Doesn't mean like postmodern quantum polynomial time. It means quantum polynomial time with post selection. So it's the class of problems you can do in polynomial time with a quantum computer, you know, if you just have one additional primitive of being able to make a measurement and then kill yourself if you don't like the outcome. And then, of course, post condition on remaining alive. It seems to me that if you take the Everett view very seriously, then maybe this is the right complexity class. Then, you know, of course the question is, well, all right, well, so it's clear that you could do NP complete problems in polynomial time, for example, in this class, because you just go into a superposition of guessing every possible solution, right? And then you post select on having happened to guess the right solution, right? So if there's no solutions, then you're sort of out of luck. But actually, you can fix that, because what you do is with some tiny probability, you just don't do anything at all. And then if you find yourself in the universe where you didn't do anything, then with overwhelming probability, there was no solution. Because if there was one, you would have been in one of the universes where you did guess a solution. Yes. Well, you get to make a measurement and then assume that the outcome of that measurement will be one, let's say. Okay? Yes. Yeah, that's what post-selection means. Right. I mean, you could also think of it as you keep repeating your computation until this outcome is a specific thing, or equivalent ways of looking at it. So then my result was I was able to characterize this class post BQP exactly in terms of a classical complexity class, which is called PP. Maybe if you don't know what that is, maybe it's not so exciting to you. But it's probabilistic polynomial time. It's like the class of problems that corresponds to, like, you're given a Boolean formula and you want to know, are at least half of the assignments to this formula satisfying, right? That's that you could actually solve that problem efficiently if you had a quantum computer with post-selection. If that's not quite obvious to you, it shouldn't be. But so actually, the other interesting thing is, based on that, I was able to give a new proof, a quantum computing-based proof of probably like the most famous classical complexity theorem about PP, which is that this class PP is closed under intersection, right? If you have two languages in PP, then their intersection is also in PP. And it turns out that this, you know, which was a major discovery in the early 90s, once you view PP in this quantum way, the proof of that is completely trivial. So. Anyway, but the result I want to show you in my remaining time is that BQP with polynomial size quantum advice can be simulated in post BQP with polynomial size classical advice. Okay? In other words, anything you can do with this quantum advice, well, you could also do with polynomial size classical advice, just provided you're willing to post-select, or if you're not willing to post-select, then use exponentially more computation time, right? But information theoretically, you know, you could say that the quantum advice is not really more powerful than classical advice. It's just that it takes you more computation to kind of extract what the classical advice is trying to tell you. So what's the intuition? Well, I'm going to imagine an advisor, Alice, and a post-BQP machine, Bob. So let's suppose that, okay, so Alice wanted to send Bob this quantum message, right? I mean, this is what an advisor does. It tries to help the student, right, by giving them, you know, some knowledge, maybe not specifically related to what problem they want to solve, but, you know, just some general knowledge that will help them, right? You know, right, as Alice is an advisor, okay? So she wanted to send Bob a q-qubit quantum state, but she only has a classical channel now, okay, to help him out. So what'll she do instead? Well, she'll send him. This is Greg Cooperberg's term. I've adopted it. I really like it. She's going to send him a Darwinian training set of inputs, okay, and you're going to see what that means on the next slide. She's going to send him a set of inputs that Bob should use to train himself. So that he can reconstruct this quantum state psi on his own without Alice's help. Okay? And so how does Alice manage to do this? Well, here's what she says to Bob, all right? Bob, all right, she says. And that only adds a constant to the message length. You can say that, okay? Bob, if you use the maximally mixed state in place of my quantum message, then x sub 1, or it was one of Bob's, you know, possible inputs, or let's say one of the SAT instances you might want to solve. That's the lexicographically first input of yours for which you'll output the wrong answer with probability at least a third. But if you post-select or condition on succeeding on X1, then X2 is the next input for which you'll output the wrong answer with probability at least a third. But if you condition on succeeding on X1 and X2, then X3 is the next one where you're going to fail, and so on. Okay? If you've succeeded on all the previous inputs, then this, you know, X of T, this is the next one where you're going to fail with some appreciable probability. Okay? So she's going to give him a list of such inputs. Okay, now just a technicality. I'm going to assume that Alice's quantum message was boosted, right? Which means she just, you know, just take a logarithmic number of copies of the message, right? And that's going to push the error probability down from like a third to 1/3 polynomial. Okay, that'll be convenient. So now the crucial claim is that this message from Alice is going to be polynomial size. She only needs to send with t equals O of Q inputs, x1 up to xt to Bob. And then with those inputs, Bob will be able to evaluate, at, let's say, f of x for any input x, right? Because he'll just say, all right, well, I just find the lexicographically last input, you know, but which is still before that x that I'm interested in, right? And then I'll start with the maximally mixed state, and then I'll post-select on, you know, having gotten the right answer for that x1 up to xt. And then once I get to X, I know by assumption that that I have to succeed on that X with probability at least 2/3, right? Because the next, you know, because Alice has told me that the next input where I'm going to fail with probability at least 1/3 is below that, right? Is X equals 1, right? So that's how Bob is going to compute F. But the key thing that we have to prove is, well, why is it that Alice only needs to specify or send a polynomial number of these inputs to Bob? All right, well, I'll just give you a sketch of the proof. Okay, so first of all, because he succeeds on any of these inputs with a very high probability, so therefore, you know, if he just evaluates, you know, f of x for any of these x's and then uncomputes, then the quantum advice state he started with will be damaged only slightly. Okay, that's a quantum information thing, which is really easy to show. And based on that, you can show that if Bob were to try x1 to xt simultaneously, were to try to evaluate all of them with the true advice state, okay, yeah, so, all right, sorry, I switched the order. Okay, the first thing that I'm saying is that, by assumption, Bob succeeds on all of these inputs simultaneously with probability at most 2/3 to the t, okay? Because, you know, by assumption, right? Because Alice has kept saying that, well, this is the next input where you know, you're going to fail with probability 1/3 if you start with a maximally mixed state, right? So that's clear. Okay, what I was saying is you can decompose the maximally mixed state in along any orthogonal basis you want, right? You know, so Bob doesn't have to know sort of which is the true basis, you know, of orthogonal vectors into which he should, you know, be decomposing the maximally mixed state, right? He doesn't have to know that. He just, you know, you could just decompose it into, well, this is the true advice vector that Alice wanted to send, and these are 2^-q-1 orthogonal vectors. Well, I can't put my arm into n dimensions for n greater than 3, but you get the idea. Okay, so then if we suppose that you know, you can then sort of track the evolution of each of these 2^q orthogonal components independently. So if you suppose that Bob were to start out with the true advice state, then he's going to succeed on all of the inputs with let's say like at least a 9/10 probability or something, right? So therefore he's going with the maximally mixed state, he's going to succeed on all of the inputs with probability like 9/10 times 2^-q, but then when t gets large enough, then that's going to become smaller than that, which is a contradiction. Okay. That's the basic point. All right, so I'll just mention recently I was able to improve this. So what I can show now is that if you have BQP with polynomial size quantum advice, then that can actually be simulated in QMA with polynomial size classical advice. But what's QMA? Well, it stands for quantum Merlin-Arthur. This is the way we name things in complexity, Merlin-Arthur. And it's the quantum generalization of NP. So in other words, the class of problems for which if the answer is yes, then you can, there's some polynomial size witness or proof that, you know, which is a quantum state, which, you know, if you give that to a quantum computer, then it can check, yes, this quantum state proves that this assertion is true, and it can do that in quantum polynomial time. Okay. So that's QMA, and it's not that hard to see that QMA is contained in post-BQP, which is the same as PP. So this is a strengthening of the result that BQP with quantum advice is contained in post-BQP with classical advice. And actually, I got yet another improvement, which is that if you take QCMA with polynomial size quantum advice, so this is quantum classical Merlin-Arthur. So now Merlin is classical, but Arthur is quantum, meaning that the proof or the witness is classical, but the verifier who checks the proof is a quantum computer. Okay, that's QCMA. All right, now if you take that QCMA and you give it quantum advice, okay, then you can switch around what's quantum and what's classical. You can simulate that. You can simulate the classical witness and the quantum advice using a quantum witness and classical advice. Yes. So, really, it was actually something stronger than that, which is it's saying that, you know, if you're given this polynomial-sized quantum advice, you don't have to trust the quantum advice. You can just be given a polynomial-sized quantum, you can be given a polynomial-sized classical string that you trust, and then a polynomial-sized quantum state that you don't have to trust. Using the classical advice, you can verify that the quantum advice state you're given really was the right advice state. Okay, so. That seems fairly powerful. I mean, certainly it's not what you would intuitively expect if you thought of these quantum states as being given like an exponential amount of advice or information as opposed to just a polynomial amount of information. All right, so this is the zoo. Some of you have seen this, and I guess the frontier right now is that there is a terrifying beast which has been rampaging and running loose in the zoo of late. And this beast is called All. It's the class of all languages whatsoever. And the problem we're finding now is that if you take this polynomial-sized quantum advice and you add it to powerful enough complexity classes, then it seems like you do get the class of all languages, right? So a simple example is if you took post-BQP, right? Because here, you could, it's like this. I could just give you a quantum advice state, which is a superposition over all possible inputs, x, you know, of x tensor f of x, right, of like the answer if you're given x. And then, whatever input you have, if you want to evaluate f of x, all you have to do is measure the advice state and then post-select on getting the right x, right? So, all right, duh. But then, you know, a less obvious thing, Ron Ruz, in a recent paper, showed that if you have a quantum interactive proof system and the verifier gets polynomial-sized quantum advice, that also lets you decide any language whatsoever. And, you know, people, well, at least, you know, computer scientists ask sometimes, well, what do you mean by any language, right? And the answer is any language. So, okay. But there is good news. The good news is that this tiger seems to have nothing specifically to do with quantum computing. Okay, it's not our fault. In particular, you know, if you just replace this polynomial-sized quantum advice by polynomial-sized classical randomized advice, you get exactly the same thing. Okay, so you know, it's kind of hard for people to argue that this shows that quantum states are extravagant objects because the same thing is true for classical probability distributions, right? You know, which of course no one objects to. So, it's actually, you can say, so you could say that, for example, IP/RPoly equals all. Okay, classical IP. Because in both of these observations or results, I mean, what you're doing is, as soon as you get the quantum advice, you measure it in the standard basis. Okay, I mean, it's, I don't know what it's like. It's like having some like airplane in your garage and just using it to drive down the street or something. Okay, so you're just measuring the state in the standard basis, so it might as well just be a distribution over classical strings. Okay. So an oracle is something that you can query and that then, you know, gives you the answer to some question. But the oracle is not, you know, designed to help you. Okay. It's, you know, it's indifferent to human needs and wants. Okay. The oracle might actually be like, you could think of it as the problem for you to solve. Like, you're given some input x, and now you want to find some question that you could ask of the oracle for which it will answer yes, right? So then, you know, the oracle is like a problem. advice is something which you're just explicitly given. So it's like a polynomial-sized string, whereas oracles are like this exponential sequence of answers to questions. And the advice is kind of optimized to help you solve whatever problem you're trying to solve. So you can consider, for example, when you have both advice and an oracle, right? And maybe, you know, that makes it clear. So then you get an oracle, which might be trying to stump you, and then you get advice, which could depend on the oracle, and which is trying to give you information about the oracle and trying to act as your ally, right? So, okay, yeah, good question. So, okay, so I'll just give you some conjectures. First of all, I think that this all tiger can be quarantined. In particular, I think if you were to take QMA with polynomial-sized quantum advice, so now we've got not classical witness and quantum advice, not quantum witness and classical advice, but you guessed it, quantum witness, quantum advice. I think that even then you should be able to simulate that in with poly-sized classical advice and with post-selection, but I haven't been able to prove that yet. Okay, I also conjecture that the question of whether classical advice can always replace quantum advice is not independent of Zermelo-Frankel set theory. Very, very bold conjecture that I'm willing to make about that, okay? Actually, I give it 50-50. I have no idea, okay? So, and then similarly for the question of whether classical proofs can always replace quantum proofs. In other words, of whether QCMA is equal to QMA. Although I would conjecture that the answer to these last two questions is the same answer. Okay, they're basically the same question in different guises. Although I don't know a reduction. So, all right. So summary. This is kind of to classical computer scientists. Yes, based on the physical evidence that we have today, I mean the state of n particles is an exponentially long vector. So welcome to quantum world. Okay, but you know, for most complexity theoretic purposes, you know, I think, if you're scared by this, then you should already be scared by classical probability distributions, because these are also exponential things. And you know, I wish I could end on a more profound note, but the difference between them is that one of them has minus signs and the other one doesn't. So thank you. What? I'm sorry. Could you say again what the difference is? Yeah. Well, sometimes they're different, but I mean, just in these kind of settings of complexity theory, they seem. You're saying that like in the many worlds interpretation, you know, all of these things in some sense, you know, really exist. Whereas. So the difference between them is that you can do BQP in the quantum case and not the classical case. I mean, yes, I agree with that. But you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, quantum states are ontological. I don't know. I'm too ignorant to comment on such things. But yeah. So there was actually Stephen Fenner sent me like a little paper where he proved where he looked at post RQP and post ZQP, which I think is what you want to consider as opposed to post EQP. EQP really depends on the choice of gate set. It's really not even a well-defined class, in my opinion. But he could characterize post RQP and post ZQP. So post RQP is equal to classical complexity class, which is called co C equal P. Like C underscore equal P, and then post ZQP is equal to C equal P intersect co C equal P. So again, you can characterize in terms of classes we've already seen. Yeah. Yes, sorry. Go on. Actually, I don't know, but go on. Oh, that, yeah, sure, okay, I know what you mean. You mean non-collapsing measurements. Yeah, I mean that's in my hidden variables paper, actually. I mean the one about kind of seeing the trajectory of a hidden variable. That's essentially the same as what you're saying, as the non-collapsing measurements. So that lets you do graph isomorphism. You know, it lets you do all statistical zero knowledge relative to an oracle. It doesn't let you just do NP-complete problems. So it's much less powerful than when you get to, you know, actually post-select an outcome. When you know get to just like take a measure. I mean, okay. When you say you get to undo it, I assume you mean you get to remember the first outcome, right? Because then what happens then is that you can like if you just have a state that's a superposition of two things, you can learn both of them. That lets you do yeah. Yeah, and that lets you do stuff like graph isomorphism. So I have a class I define which is called DQP, which it's called DQP. So anyway, it kind of encompasses that. But yeah.